thanks for making it back for the fifth week after the gap week. You're never sure what's going to happen, you know, whether people are going to remember that we still have a class. But our topic this week is vegetarianism, the Jewish vegetarian. And I did send out by email the flyer for the summer course. Just briefly, for anyone who for some reason the email isn't getting to them, it will be a four-week class, God willing, starting June 25th. It will be Wednesdays like this one at 10 a.m. It will be at Yeshivat Or Chaim, the boys' high school on the corner of Almore and Faywood. Easy, very easy to get there from here. You just drive, you know, south. It's straight down the road from here. And there is no charge. Registration is online either via email to the address that I gave you in the email. If anyone needs it, I can give it to you. Or alternatively, just email me and I'll take care of it. There's also a website where you can register. It doesn't make a difference. There's no charge. Come learn. The topic is a beginner's guide to the origins of Jewish prayer. That's what we'll be talking about. Where did Jewish prayer come from? The earliest stages of its development. And I'm hoping it'll be fun.
Starts at
10 o'clock, yeah.
Also, my question was perfect.
Oh.
On the Yisker prayer, because you...
Right, except the Yisker is only about 800 years old, whereas we're going to be going back. We're going to be going back earlier, but we'll see. We'll see how far forward we get. In any case, we're talking vegetarianism. We've already talked about eating as an act that one may perform either to satisfy instinct, like an animal, or to fulfill a divine command, like the relationship established between God and human beings in the Garden of Eden. We've talked about food as a precious act, as a precious resource that we offer to God when we discussed the korban, the idea of sacrifice. And today I want to look at a different facet, how we relate to having animals as the source of our food. Now, I don't want to put anyone on the spot by asking the following question. So if you don't want to answer truthfully, you don't have to. Right. But do we have vegetarians? Do we have vegetarians in the room?
Almost.
Yeah, I'm an almost also.
I'm just fish. I haven't eaten.
A pescatarian, okay. It sounds like a version of Christianity, doesn't it? Pescatarian, Presbyterian.
My daughter.
Your daughter, yes. Right. So my daughter also. I have a daughter who's a vegetarian. I'm a wannabe vegetarian. As is my other daughter also. She's also a wannabe vegetarian. The difference is that her parents aren't allowing her to do so. But it may surprise people, but Judaism seems to be fairly strongly inclined on the side of vegetarianism, despite the fact that the eating of animals is enshrined in Jewish, not just in Jewish text, biblically, but in Jewish law. So we're going to have to talk about this sort of love-hate relationship that Judaism has with vegetarianism. And I wanted to start with a source from Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. We've seen him over and over again in this course because he just has so much to say and he says it so beautifully. This is from the beginning of the 19th century. And he writes the following in his work, Horeb. He says, "There are probably no creatures that require more the protective divine word against the presumption of man than the animals, which, like man, have sensations and instincts, but whose body and powers are nevertheless subservient to man." What he has established here, besides saying something, you know, in very nice flowery language, is he seems to establish that God wants the animal to be protected from the human being. Right? Am I reading him correctly? He's saying that the animal has sensations and instincts like we do. He's almost saying the animal has feelings. He's not quite there, but sensations and instincts like the human being. But the animal is vulnerable to the human being. And therefore, there is a need for the protective divine word against the presumption of man. Now, what protective divine word do we have to protect? What is it that God does to protect human to protect animals from human beings?
Man's conscience.
Conscience, maybe.
Well, yeah, we're not supposed to hunt unless it's for food. So hunting, per se, sport hunting is not allowed.
How do you know? You happen to be right. I just wanted to know what your source was. You know, Rabbi Yechezkel Landau. Rabbi Yechezkel Landau was a rabbi in Czechoslovakia in, I believe, the late 18th century. May have been early 19th, but he was asked, a Jew asked him, am I allowed to participate in a hunt going on? You know, they used to have hunts on these estate grounds. And he said, that's not a Jewish thing to do. You're not going to be able to eat that which you kill, because, of course, it hasn't undergone kosher slaughter. Hunting for sport, he said, was inappropriate. So we do have this concept. The question is, where do we get the sensibility from? Now, we have a broad sensibility that we are taught Talmudically is supposed to be a Jewish sensibility. The Talmud has a line that says that the children of Abraham and Sarah are supposed to be three things. Rachmanim, Baishanim, Gomlei Chasadim. Rachmanim means merciful, Baishan means modest, and Gomel Chesed means generous. These are supposed to be the hallmarks of the Jews, so much so that when the Talmud quotes this, it's doing it in the context of a story that happens in the life of King David. Without going into the story in great length, King Saul preceded King David. In his last years, Saul was consumed by a jealousy of David, because one of those things you're not supposed to do in the Middle East happened, and that was that King David, the new king, was coronated before King Saul was dead. It's a bad idea anywhere to name the new king while the old king is still alive, but certainly in the Middle East. It doesn't work well. So the result was that Saul actually pursues David in an attempt to kill him. And at one point, David takes refuge in a city of priests called Nov. Long story about how he ends up there, how he gets their help, not the point. The point is that word gets back to Saul that this city has helped. That city has helped David, and he orders the destruction of the city. Almost everybody in the city is killed. Now, that happened to be a city of Kohanim, a city of priests. There was a separate community that depended on the priests for their livelihood. And these were people called the Givonim. The Givonim depended on the priests, so that when the priests were killed out, the Givonim starved. Later, it's a whole story. Obviously, this story requires a very long class. And yeah, you're wondering, like, why didn't they teach me about this in Hebrew school? But when you think about it, you'll know why. It's a little hard. It's a hard story for kids to absorb, I think. But the Givonim come to David and say, we want revenge on the family of Saul. And what we want is for you to turn over 7 males from his family for us to execute. That's their demand for him. Now, I'm deliberately not going to tell you the rest of the story, because you won't sleep tonight. But the point of the story, and the reason I'm quoting it, is because of what the Talmud then says happened as a result of this. The Givonim were sort of borderline to be Jewish. They had tried to convert to Judaism, but their conversion was for gain rather than for out of sincerity. It's a longer story as well. And they were sort of on the bubble. Will they be accepted? Will they not be accepted? And David writes them out. He says, we're not going to accept them as Jews. Because of this action, it's demonstrated cruelty. If you're going to be a Jew, you have to have 3 traits: cruelty, modesty, and generosity. Now, that doesn't mean we get to write off. What did I say?
I said cruelty.
That was good. Now, that's where the Givonim made their mistake. No, yes, mercy, modesty, and generosity. So those are the 3 traits that Jews are supposed to have. And that's one of our sources in general for the idea that we're supposed to be merciful people. The question then becomes, though, what about mercy to animals? How do we know that there is a protective divine word that is supposed to be shielding animals? And how do we understand, then, our license to eat meat? If we're really supposed to protect them, then why are we eating meat? Yeah.
Weren't the paschal lambs and the things that were brought to the priests, and they were either divided or used by the priests?
Mm-hmm.
Back to Exodus.
Right.
sacrifice?
So most sacrifices are indeed eaten, either part of them or all of them. There are, though, there is something called a burnt offering, in which the animal is slaughtered and then it's put on the altar and no one's eating anything. So you can't say, well, this is actually for people to eat in that case. We talked about the value of the offering already, you know, in the previous class and the message that it brings, but without a doubt, yes, you're killing animals. That's clear cut.
And I think you said it has to be the best one.
The burnt offering, right, because it's the one that you don't have anything for yourself. Yeah. So let's understand what's going on here. We have to start with source number two. Sorry for those, you know, it's you know, early in the morning to be shocked with a story like that. I apologize. But take a look at source number two. This begins with a passage we've already seen before. This is God addressing human beings in the Garden of Eden, and God said, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth. And every tree with fruit of the tree bearing seed, to you it shall be for food." That's the first verse that I quote you in source number two. And in it we are told that we are supposed to be vegetarian. Which fits the fact that we said in week one that human beings fundamentally are created as part of the animal kingdom. We are... As far as the language of Bereshit, of Genesis goes, we are part of that kingdom until God gives us a command and that sets us apart. However, after the Mabul, after the flood in the era of Noah, we're then told the following, the second part of source number two. This is also Genesis chapter 9, sentence 3. "All that crawls that is alive will be for you to eat. Like vegetation, I have given you all." There is no law of kashrut. There's no law of keeping kosher at this stage. Everything is all right. We are taught that there was one idea, based on the verses here, that they're not allowed to take something from an animal while the animal is still alive. There's a certain cruelty in that, obviously. The animal has to be slaughtered first before you're going to take from it in order to eat it. But God permits them to eat animals. Then in Leviticus, in chapter, I think it's 11, we are given the laws of kashrut. That's for Jews specifically. This earlier verse is for humanity. But then we're given the laws of kosher food. And then, take a look at source number three, we move a step further with the law of shechita, of kosher slaughter, in which we are told the following. Source number three. "When God broadens your borders," that he's addressing the Jews in the wilderness before they enter the land that will become Israel. So, "when God broadens your borders, as he has told you he will, and you will say, 'I will eat flesh,' for your spirit will desire to eat flesh, at every desire of your spirit you shall eat flesh." Does it sound a little redundant? I mean, to a certain extent, that's the way biblical text works. Like, you have redundancies, but keep the redundancy in mind. In other words, yes, it's true that biblical text often appears to repeat itself, but we tend to assume that there is something to be learned from the repetitions, and here we'll see something to be learned from the repetition. "When the place God will choose to place his name will be distant from you," this is a reference to what becomes Jerusalem, right? When the temple is far away from you, because now you're not living in the wilderness where you have a camp and everybody is right around the temple, but instead you could be living hours and hours away, or even days away, based on their travel. "So when the place God will choose to place his name will be distant from you, and you will slaughter of your cattle and sheep, which God has given you, as I have instructed you, you shall eat it in your gates at your every desire." Notice the repetition again of "at your every desire," right? But he says, you're going to slaughter it wherever you are. The reason why it's necessary to emphasize that you'll be far from the temple is that we're taught that when the Jews are in the wilderness, they're only allowed to eat meat if it's from a korban, if it's from a sacrifice. If they offer some to God, then they're also allowed to have for themselves. When you enter into the land, you can't, every time you want to have burgers, you're going to go to the temple. That's going to be difficult. So therefore, the statement is made, okay, now you don't have to do so. So what you see here is an evolution in which we start out vegetarian, then everything is permitted, then Jews get the laws of kosher, and then you get this law of sacrifice. Clear? So my question to you is, that first leap, where we went from vegetarian to eating meat, why did that change? Yeah?
Well, there were unlikely things growing at that point in time at the beginning, right?
That's an interesting idea, a pragmatic point of view.
And plus, if you didn't live in an arid environment, you wouldn't have growth.
Well, so both are practical. In other words, one is post-flood as their growth, and number two, post-flood, potentially if you're living in an area without irrigation, although I imagine right after the flood, that's not such a problem. Yeah, if you're living in a desert environment, so what will you have? To which I would respond with two questions. Regarding your first point, Noah brings either two or seven of each animal, which may be actually two pair and seven pair, so maybe it's 4 and 14, depending on how you read the text. If they start eating those, we're going to run into trouble.
Right.
So, I don't know. I would think plants would propagate faster, or at least more broadly. Animals basically, when you're dealing with livestock, you're talking about once a year, maybe twice a year, depending on the animal. And it's not multiple births. I mean, these aren't animals that are producing like fish, although fish maybe. But but that's one question. The other is, if you're living in the desert climate, what are your animals eating? I'm not sure I would tie this to the flood. Yeah, you were going to tell you that point? Yeah, if you're in a desert area, your animals have nothing to eat. Yeah, Stephen.
I'm looking at the point of view of nature and animals. Yeah. Some animals are vegetarian, and some animals are meat eaters.
Yep.
So, but it's the human, the ideal seems to be vegetarian, but the physical desire, like the good inclination and the evil inclination, can overpower. Therefore, to control your desire, you should be a vegetarian.
So wait, you confused me. I had you until the end there. Then you did a little left turn.
You should be a vegetarian. That way you're controlling your desire for meat.
Well, before we get to the you should, I want to know historically why the biblical text changes it. Why does God say first, eat the grass? And then afterwards he says, okay, you can have animals as well. One view would go back to the sin which triggered the flood. Remember we talked about Noah bringing his offering after the flood and how important that offering was. Because the sin that led to the flood was, this was 2 weeks ago, but you can remember. What was the sin that led to the flood? No, Sodom and Gomorrah later. The sin that led to the flood was people taking advantage of others, violent theft we talked about, right? That's why Noah's offering, this display of generosity, is so potent. He has shown that he has grown past the sins that led to the destruction in the first place. So it could be, one way to read it, is that this is a concession to the human aggressive nature that's displayed before the flood. In other words, God says, I need to give you an outlet. Human beings have demonstrated that they are aggressive. So let them take it out on the beasts instead of taking it out on other people. That's one suggestion that is made. Well, it's terrible if you're an animal. It protects the human beings. But yes, that's difficult. Another suggestion, actually, before moving here, when I was in Pennsylvania, I taught a class on vegetarianism at one point, and someone there offered a very interesting suggestion, which we're actually going to come back to later on, and that it was to show the distinction between man and animal, in the sense that human beings get into trouble when they view themselves as beasts. And there was one rabbi who, the story is told, I think it was Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, who passed away in 1986, I think of him, the story was that he was on an airplane And he was there with his kids or his grandkids, whatever the story was, and somebody complimented him on how well his kids were listening to him and said, you know, my kids don't listen to me at all. So he said to him, well, where do you teach your kids that human beings came from? Right? Where did human beings come from? So he said, well, we came from monkeys. So, you know, basically his answer was, you know, you teach that your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents ultimately go back to being monkeys, right? And that with each further generation, you are progressing. If we're going to tell our kids that actually our ancestors were wonderful and they stood at Sinai and they were spiritual and close to God and so on, then they're going to have a greater respect for those who came before them. And there's more to the story than that. But the point is that if you teach your children that man is the highest form of animal, then fundamentally you communicate something about what can be expected of them, which is to say, they're part of the animal kingdom. The downside of teaching children that is a clear danger of them saying, well, you know, this is who I am. I'm part of the animal kingdom. There is a need to say we are different. And by saying you can't eat human beings, but you can eat animals, you put the animal in this lower category, potentially, and and divide it, separate it from the human being. So that's another idea that's out there. I'm going to come back to that idea a little bit later. But there's another idea. Take a look at source number 4. In the 13th century, Rabbi Moses Nachmanides, also known as Ramban, offers another suggestion. He says, moving, living spirits have a soul of some degree, in which regard they resemble thinking spirits. He's distinguishing between animals as creatures that move and live, and human beings which think. They can make choices to help themselves and to feed themselves, and they flee from pain and death, describing the animal. When they sinned, and all flesh warped its path on earth, it was decreed that the animals should die in the flood. He's following the Midrashic teaching, which says that not only did the human beings sin, but even the animals sinned. How the animals could have sinned, what it was that they displayed, is a longer discussion. But this is based on the fact that the biblical verses that describe the sins pre-flood say that all flesh on earth had become corrupt. So the rabbis understood that to mean the animals as well. So therefore, everything is supposed to die. For Noah's sake, some of them were saved to maintain their species. And so God gave humanity permission to slaughter and eat animals. The animals were only maintained for Noah's sake. In other words, God creates the animals in the beginning and he says, well, they're mine. You don't get to eat them. However, once they're only saved for Noah's sake, and Noah brings them on the boat and supports them for a year, and they only survive because of him, then he, so to speak, takes ownership. So that's another suggestion that's offered for this change.
So because he takes ownership, we can now eat them?
They're his, to do with as he wishes. That would be the suggestion that's being made. These are difficult, right? All of these are difficult explanations.
Well, it doesn't tie with the concept that all creatures are God's creatures, like the big concept.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're saying that's gone away.
Right.
You haven't said that yet.
Nope.
So it's very confusing.
Yeah, and it's only going to get more confusing now. Because we have a biblical prohibition. A biblical prohibition that is called Bal Tashchit, or Bal Tashchis. Anyone ever hear that phrase? Bal Tashchis? What does it mean?
Don't destroy.
Right. Not to destroy. Not to waste. Right? Usually quoted by mothers to their children who are refusing to eat at the table. Right? You're not allowed to waste food. Eat everything on your plate. To which Maimonides says you have to leave stuff on your plate. You're not supposed to eat everything, but that's another story. But there is this principle of not destroying. So, according to that, I shouldn't be destroying the animals just because I feel like eating them. However, there is an important principle which I brought you in source number 5. I like this source. It's a fun source. Rav Papa. You have to know, walking into this passage here in the Talmud, that Rav Papa was a beer manufacturer.
Oh.
He's a sage and a beer manufacturer. This source goes back to 4th century Common Era. Rav Papa said, one who could drink beer and instead drinks wine is violating the prohibition, do not destroy. his statement is that beer is cheaper. So therefore, if you're spending on wine, you're being wasteful. You should buy my beer. That's the. This is a commercial, so to speak. He says you should be drinking beer, not wine. But the Talmud then responds, this is not so. The concern for destroying one's body is greater. Meaning, the beer that they had was considered to be bad for your digestive system. They had two different kinds of beer. It's not clear which one is being referred to here. They had beer they made with barley, like you know today's beer, and then they also had date beer that they would make. They would ferment dates. It's not clear which one this is in the discussion here. But the Talmud says, well, you know, it's true you're not supposed to waste, but you're also not supposed to destroy your health. So, you know, someone is saying to you, finish everything on your plate, and you say, well, that's not good for me. The concern of not destroying your body is primary. So maybe the argument could be made that the justification for eating meat would be, if I need it for my health, granted I am destroying, nonetheless, I need it in order to be healthy. There are certain things that are, that you know, protein, iron, that I can get out of meat, bad cholesterol, that I can't get if I'm eating vegetables. So, therefore, there are things that, there are reasons why I should eat meat, from a health perspective. But the second issue is a greater problem. The first problem I brought was this bal tashchis, not to waste. But the second problem is a greater problem. And this is what we call in Hebrew tsar balei chayim. The word tsar, what does tsar mean in Hebrew? Tsadi ayin resh? Emeya? Pain. Sorry? Saros. Yeah, it's funny. The word saros is actually similar in sound, but it's a different word. The saros are troubles. The tsar is pain. The tsar balei chayim means paining living creatures. You're not allowed to cause pain to a living creature. Take a look at source number 6, please. This is the classic source for this, and this is, I believe, what Rabbi Hirsch was referring to in source number 1 when he talked about the divine word protecting animals. A calf was being brought for slaughter. It hit its head under Rebbe's garment. Rebbe is the nickname for Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He gained the nickname Rebbe because Rebbe means my mentor. And he was the mentor for his entire generation of Jews in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. He was the one who led the effort to canonize the Mishnah, which is the recording of, the most basic recording of Jewish law and the spoken tradition that explains biblical text. It was something that he did in order to protect Torah as the Romans were trying to destroy it. He is the giant of his generation, both religiously from his scholarship, and in terms of his piety. He was renowned for being somebody of extra piety, and politically, he was very close with the Roman leadership, so he was the lobbyist. If the Jews ever had a problem with something going on coming down from the Roman government, he was the one who would go to them to try to get things improved. So keep that in mind as you read this story. A calf was being brought for slaughter. It hid its head under Rebbe's garment. It was crying. Rebbe said, "Go. You were created for this." In heaven, they said, since he does not have mercy, let suffering befall him. And in fact, what happens is he suffers incredibly from a bowel disease of some kind, which ultimately leads to his death in the end. There are suggestions that are brought based on the description of it in the Talmud. It's suggested that it was irritable bowel disorder and complications that arose from it. But his suffering, the Talmud says his suffering is not natural, but rather his suffering is something that is assigned to him by God as a punishment for saying, well, go for slaughter. That's what you were created for. Even though the Talmud doesn't reject eating meat, what's their objection? Lack of mercy. I mean, the animal doesn't understand his speech. It may understand tone of voice, right? It may comprehend that. But the point is that Rebbe, that sensitivity is demanded of him. He has to be sensitive to the animal's condition. And I think it isn't just because he expressed it to the animal and made the animal feel bad in the moments before it was slaughtered, but because it's wrong for him. That's not the way he should feel about slaughtering and eating an animal. And look at the rest of the source now. This next source happens years later. One day, Rebbe's maid was sweeping out the house. She swept out some rodents. Rebbe said to her, "Leave them be. For it is written," he quotes a verse from Psalms, "His mercy is upon all of his creations." In heaven, they said, "Since he displayed mercy, we will have mercy upon him," and at that point, his pain is mitigated. Because he has mercy on the rodents. Now, I realize people's tolerance here, you know, for the two sides of this story may be challenged. In other words, we are far more likely to eat meat than we are to allow rodents in our house. And here it's kind of the reverse. He's punished for his response regarding the meat, and then he's rewarded because he was merciful for having mice around the house. Nonetheless, the statement that's made, I think, is very clear, that the cruelty is inappropriate and the mercy is what's expected.
Rabbi,
yeah?
It's so current, because you know what happened in Chilliwack?
Yeah.
This is absolutely current, where some workers in the largest, these were dairy cows, and they tortured them or whipped them or whatever. There's a film made of it.
Yeah.
And the discussion on the way up here was, should they be penalized by law? And there were big discussions because these animals suffered.
Yeah.
This is exactly what went on today.
Right.
Exactly.
There you go. Well, take a look at number 7, please. Number 7, we return to Rabbi Hirsch, and this is his follow-up to what I brought you in source number 1. He says, man becomes, he's describing a human being who is not merciful to the animal. He says, man becomes the torturer of the animal soul, which has been subjected to him only for the fulfillment of humane and wise purposes. Sometimes out of self-interest, at other times in order to satisfy a whim, sometimes out of thoughtlessness. Yes, even for the satisfaction of crude satanic desire. And yes, he uses the word satanic. Meaning that this is something that's emerging from some impure place. Behold, he says, here you are faced with God's teaching, Hashem being the word for God, which obliges you not only to refrain from inflicting unnecessary pain on any animal, but to help, and when you can, to lessen the pain whenever you see an animal suffering, even through no fault of yours. Above all, those to whom the care of young minds has been entrusted, see to it that they respect both the smallest and the largest animal as being, which, like man, have been summoned to the joy of life and have been granted sensitivity. And do not forget that the boy who in crude joy finds delight in the convulsions of an injured beetle or the anxiety of a suffering animal will soon also be dumb towards human pain. So he's added a point here. In addition to the fact that we are not supposed to be cruel, which from an ethical perspective is important, he warns you of the consequences of allowing people to develop a cruel personality and where this is going to go.
What era was the reference?
He's writing in the 1830s. This idea, if you flip the page, is a biblical idea. Right? We said initially that this is God's word protecting the animal. Take a look at source number 8, a verse from Exodus. When you see your enemy's donkey sprawled beneath its load, shall you abstain from aiding him? You shall aid him. There are a couple of different ways to translate the sentence precisely, but the message is the same in all of them. You have an obligation to aid, even though it's your enemy's donkey. The point is, you're helping him not because of the owner. It's not because you like the guy. It's because of the animal. There actually is a discussion Talmudically. If you have your friend's donkey on one hand and you have the enemy's donkey on the other hand, which one should you help first? And the answer is?
Whichever needs it the most.
Nope. Enemy's donkey first, because you have to learn self-control and you have to overpower your enmity for somebody else.
Yeah. The thing in Toronto in the boiling hot summer, dogs locked up in hot cows with the river on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, smash the river to get this animal out.
Right. Right. And that's, I mean, you hear, unfortunately, you hear those, and you even hear about it with babies. I mean, it's just horrific. Every time that happens, you hear about this on the news. You're like, you wonder, people leaving children in hot cars. It's insane. Anyway, you have here a biblical model of avoiding paining animals, such that, well, you see it there, and I brought you also another passage, source number 9. I'm going a little quickly because there's a whole piece that I want to get to that you see coming up in sources 11 to 15 that I think is very important. But take a look at number 9, where we are told, Rav Yehuda taught, citing Rav, this is 3rd century Common Era, one may not eat until he has first given food to his animal. It is written, this is something that's said as part of the Shema, so it's said morning and evening traditionally every day. And I will put grass in your field. This is if you fulfill the commandments, God rewards you. He says, I will put grass in your field for your animal. And then it says, and you shall eat and be sated. So first God says, I'm providing for your beast. Then you shall have. But it's animal first, then human being. Yeah?
This brings back a wonderful memory that I have of my father always showing when riding with the horses.
Yeah.
And we came back, and he said, we're going to water the horses first. I know you're thirsty, but we're meant to water the horses.
Interesting. There's actually a lot of discussion about the question of whether the statement applies to water as well as food, or whether you'll say, well, water is a basic necessity for life, and therefore the human life would go. But leaving that aside, I think that he's sensitive to exactly this point. We are responsible to take care of the animal. So based on this, how is it that we are eating animals? So the result of this is not a law on the book saying don't eat animals, but rather a strong sensitivity that says you may eat animals, but make sure you're not going to be cruel when you do it. And it's not just eating them. There are other ways in which one makes use of animals. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, also known as Rama, writing in the Ashkenazi portion of the Code of Jewish Law in the very beginning of the 16th century, he says, for anything involving medical benefit or other benefit, there is no problem of paining animals. He says, if there's a benefit like medical benefit, and we're not talking here about hairspray, you know, in the eyes of a rabbit, but we're talking about where they can model tumors in an animal and develop chemotherapy that'll work on human beings, which study after study shows could not have been done if they hadn't used the animal as a model for it. I had some good sources on it, but there was just no room on the page. But he says, for that, so okay, you have to pain the animal to do it, that's one thing. But he says, therefore one may pluck a live goose's feather, meaning for use as a quill, without concern for paining animals, but we do not do this, for it is cruel. He says, it may be that you can justify it, saying, well, I have a need for a quill, and yeah, therefore I'm going to take the feather out of the goose. But he says, we don't do that. If you have a goose that's been killed for some other reason, or it died, that's one thing. But we're not going to pull a feather out of the goose in order to use it. What you're seeing here is a balance. Now, keep in mind that we are ultimately human beings. And because we are human beings, there are times when we fail in implementing this properly. Anybody remember the Rubashkin saga of a few years ago?
Yes.
So you're talking about problems there where we didn't live up to our responsibilities, and there it was to human beings, not just to animals. There also was the issue of the workers.
Our rabbi gave a sermon a couple of years ago about the fact that veal should not be kosher.
So I was going to mention that.
Considered unkosher.
Right. So that was actually the next piece in my notes. So I'm glad that was the perfect segue. Veal. So there actually are potential kosher problems with veal, even before you get into the cruelty. Number one, because it subsists largely on a diet of meat and milk that are combined together. And if an animal subsists largely on meat and milk combinations, there's some discussion about that. That's number one. But number two, because they force feed them. And they force feed them while confining them. And the result of that is that actually, potentially, you are wounding the animal in such a way that it won't be kosher. It's what we call in Hebrew a trefa. So potentially, it would not be kosher for that reason. But in terms of the discussion of inhumane treatment in general, because it's broader than just veal, indeed we may say that a person is not entitled to treat an animal in an inhumane way, and therefore it's inappropriate for us to eat it. Inhumane treatment won't necessarily make it non-kosher just because it'll fit all the rules that are in the laws of kashrut, but that doesn't mean you're supposed to eat it. Yeah, the it's important that you declare things under the right code, so to speak, in the code of law. It's not under the laws of kashrut. It's under the laws of what we call tzar balei chayim, not painting animals.
So,
yes.
So
just a second,
wait,
Sheila.
Wait,
yeah.
Wait,
hang on. I'm going to go right to left here,
really
Sheila.
It could be also that if you are cruel to the animals, you're harming the animal's health, and if the whole point of the animal is to be food for a person, then the human being may get ill from eating an ill.
Well, if they would find that, then more people would stop eating veal, I think. I think they haven't found that to be the case. I'm going right to left. I'll get to everybody on this row, and then I'll get to Stephen. Next time you're on the row. Betty?
Okay, so is that why we have vegans? Because vegetarian, you know, because the egg and the dairy is somehow cruel to the...
And I can't answer for the vegans. I'll have the vegans answer for themselves. But I think the philosophy is that any use of an animal for human gain is inappropriate. Now, animals, certainly the ones that have been domesticated, need to be milked. And they're producing eggs, and the ones that we eat there tend to be from non-fertilized sources, but they will say, well, you're keeping the animal in this place and forcing it to be just there, and therefore you are, it's a form of abuse.
So we don't consider that cruel, though.
I think we consider it a balance, and it's an important balance. You know, in the same way that there are people who have birds as pets, right? You're keeping the bird in a cage. You go to the zoo. You know, even in the nicest of zoos, you know, they're being confined. So, you know, the question is, you know, at what point do you say there is a benefit that outweighs my sensitivity? At one point, not. I mean, you could make the argument with the animals that the animals that are in the zoos are surviving longer than they would survive outside, out in the wild. The arguments are made. You know, these are all out there. Marlene.
Are there any interpretations around modern farming methods where animals spend their whole lives in pens or chicken farming?
Well, that goes right. Right. So that goes back to the Again, it goes back to the same point. If you're in violation of Tsar Balei Chayim, not to pain animals, then you're in violation of Jewish law. It won't come under the laws of kosher, because the laws of kosher are written as they're written, and it's a separate code. But it's equally a part of the code. Not painting animals is as much a part of Jewish law as anything else. So in that sense, it will be part. You know, is it rabbinic? Is it biblical? There are different elements to it. It's a part of law. It's not a simple, it's not simply as nice and simple as saying, so everything is off limits and that's that. There are parts that are permitted, there are parts that are prohibited. But yes, the prohibition against painting animals is going to pertain, I think, when you're dealing with aspects of modern farming methods. I'm not an expert on modern farming. All I know is the propaganda I've read. So, I want to be careful about that. Yeah?
So does the mashgiach check the farm?
So the mashgiach... Right.
Violation of pain.
Understood. So a mashgiach, remember, is a kosher supervisor. He is supposed to enforce the laws of keeping kosher. So from his perspective, he's going to say, that's all I'm looking at. Is this kosher or is it not kosher? There are those who have tried to... His answer will be, that's what I'm hired for. And make no mistake, all aspects of society take advantage of that. By which I mean, for example, you have an event going on, and there's something which the Orthodox rabbi who's supervising it would not approve of. Fill in the blank from your own imagination. He will still stand there and supervise the food and say the food is kosher. His presence there is of limited scope. That doesn't mean that you're supposed to now eat the food because there's a certification symbol on them. You have to ask yourself, is this something I want to be a part of? Is this something that I want to support?
What did the states do in the factories?
Yeah.
There was a mosquito there.
Absolutely.
What were you doing?
Because once again, his answer is, all I am here to do is certify that the food is kosher. I'm not here to certify that no other laws are being broken. I mean, this is in every field. Would you want a situation in which the Mashgiach also felt that he was responsible to make sure your entertainment suited him and who was getting married suited him? You end up with a very slippery slope if you arm the Mashgiach to go beyond what he's been hired to do.
He's a person. He's
yes.
He's an animal being
correct.
Abused.
Correct. And from that perspective, you're right. In other words, yes, he should be speaking up. But it's separate from declaring kosher, non-kosher. He should be speaking up because what's going on is wrong.
Right.
Having nothing to do with his role as a mashgiach. He should be speaking up if he's a delivery man and he sees it.
Right.
Yes. No, that I agree with. There's so much more we have to see. I'm just going to go to Stephen because he's been waiting so patiently and then we're going to move on. He hasn't shouted. So.
He seems to be giving reason to the people in the town or the Nazis for what I only did what I was hired to do.
No. For so many reasons.
It's a big jump. But
for so many reasons.
About the kosher, about the ethical.
Yeah.
I read an article by an Orthodox woman years ago.
Yeah.
That said, it's a disgrace to eat chickens. And not free-range chickens we're talking about that are slaughtered the old way, because there's 1,000 chickens in a room like this, and they not only torture them, they cut their beaks off, and they cut their fingers off, so that they can't harm each other. And the veal, especially the provini veal, they are hung in slings from the time they're born, and put, like, they're grown like vegetables. So if you knew how these animals are treated, so that man that's a mashgiach in many cases
what you're describing sounds horrific, but I haven't done the research on it, but I have lived near a chicken farm there for 2 years, and the chickens had beaks and the chickens had claws. So I can only tell you that this should not necessarily be automatically taken as what's going on in kosher chicken plants. Just because I know, I lived near one for 2 years, and those chickens had beaks and claws. Yes. Okay. The last. No, I really want to go into this because otherwise we'll never get to this, and you have to. The last piece of this is, I think, very important to make sure we see. And this is a point raised by Rabbi Avraham Isaac Cook. We have permission that we're given to eat animals. That we've already established. On the other hand, it sounds like we should be pushing for some form of vegetarianism. Rabbi Avraham Isaac Cook, writing in the beginning of the 20th century, wrote something called in Hebrew, Chazon HaTzimchoniyut VaShalom, A Vision of Vegetarianism and Peace, in which he argued that the ultimate goal is for human beings to return to the state of being vegetarian, but they should not do it yet. And I brought you excerpts here to try to show the way his argument flows. He begins by saying that there's a natural drive for righteousness in the human being built into the soul and who we are. And he says, no matter how cruel a person becomes, and no matter how much someone rationalizes to himself his own cruelty, ultimately, it's still there inside of the human soul, and that's why we were originally vegetarian, because that's who we are at heart. And he says, it's not meant to be extinguished forever, for us to forever be meat eaters. Take a look at source number 11. He says, it would be a desecration for this enslavement, meaning enslavement of animals, to be imprinted eternally upon the world of God, who is good to all and whose mercy is on all of his creations. Especially when the Torah has already testified that there was a time when mankind as a whole aspired to be elevated to this high ethical level. He says, it can't be that the Torah tells us we were vegetarian once and doesn't intend that we should come back to that level. There's a reason why it's there. He writes, that the details of creation are largely excluded from the Torah. There's so much that's missing there. So any piece that's included must be to teach me something. And so the initial statement of you get to eat plants, you don't get to eat animals, has to be something that has a future as well. But, he says, the sins of the human being have dragged the human being down, and this goes back to pre-flood and the cruelty that they displayed. It drags human beings down to the point where they don't reject the idea of such cruelty. And he says, go back to what we saw in the beginning, source number 3. And I emphasized it then. The text has this repetition in source number 3. When God broadens your borders, as he has told you he will, and you will say, I will eat flesh, for your spirit will desire to eat flesh. At every desire of your spirit, you shall eat flesh. And then again, at the end, you shall eat it in your gates at your every desire. Note the emphasis on the desire. So now, flip back to source number 12, and he says, there is here a hidden rebuke by the wise, meaning by God. It's a wise rebuke, and a boundary-setting alert. It is as if to say that so long as your inner ethic is not repulsed by eating animal flesh in the way that it is repulsed by human flesh, you shall eat animal flesh. For when the time comes that human ethics are revolted by animal flesh because of the ethical revulsion involved, when you no longer feel this desire, then you will not desire at all to eat any flesh, and you shall not eat it. He says the human being will advance to a stage where this will be repulsive. And at that point, the human being is supposed to stop. He says, God says multiple times, I'm only telling you to do this because you desire it. You're going to progress to a point where you don't desire it anymore. And at that point, there's no permission to do it. And he continues to say, in source 12, after the weakening of the human being, which flowed from his ethical fall, meaning this pre-flood slide of the human being, it became appropriate to eat flesh. However, he says, there's a need to eat it in order to survive now. In other words, it's not just that it's a concession because you desire it. It's because the human being needs to eat this to survive while he grows spiritually. Remember that Rabbi Cook is a mystic. He's heavily into mysticism. And what you're about to see is a product of that. He said, Rabbi Cook's belief is that if you look back in 12, the last line in 12, he says, after the weakening of the human being, which flowed from his ethical fall, it became appropriate to eat flesh, meaning that there is a physical weakening of the human being. I should have inserted the word physical to make that clear. There's a physical weakening that is a result of his ethical weakening. In other words, as Rabbi Cook understands it, the soul affects the body. If the soul becomes ethically weak, then the body follows suit. The body will become weak too. It's a mystical idea. And so he says the human being needs to eat meat in order to survive at this stage, in order to grow spiritually. And that's where you see source number 13. He says, the Torah prepared its illumination in the measure appropriate for man, with the calculation of the God who knows all, giver of the Torah, such that through this, man will also come to intellectual illumination through this process of growth over the years. And he says, there is no doubt for any intelligent thinking person that the rain mentioned in the Torah, when the Torah says, and they shall rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and the beasts and the entire land and all that crawls upon the land, it doesn't refer to a tyrannical ruler's reign exploiting nation and servants only to execute his personal wishes. He says, the fact that God gives you control of the animals is not licensed to be cruel to them. It's licensed to eat them when this is necessary until you grow. But it's not something that entitles a person to be cruel to them. That's not what is envisioned here. But then he says something that is really striking in source 14. And I know I'm rushing, I apologize. But he says, taking on vegetarianism prematurely would be catastrophic. What is he talking about? He says, how absurd it would be if while his impurity was in him, he would extend his hooves and turn to this distant righteousness. And what he means by that is the pig. Remember that there are two signs of an animal that demonstrate that it's kosher. Split hooves and that it chews its cud. The animal, these are the signs incidentally of a vegetarian animal, the chewing its cud. But the pig has split hooves, but it doesn't chew its cud. And so it's described as putting out its hooves to show you, look, I'm kosher, even though it's really not. And that's what he says here. How absurd it would be for a human being if while his impurity was in him, he would extend his hooves as if to say, look, I'm already kosher, and turns this distant righteousness, being generous with animals as though he had already completed his accounts with human beings, created in the image set by God. In other words, you can't claim that you're already there, that you're already at the stage of being a vegetarian, if you're still being cruel to human beings. There has to be a proper order to things. First develop your sensitivity to the human, then you're ready to be sensitive to the animal. And he continues and says, without doubt, this would cause great damage doing this prematurely. Because, he says, and this goes back to the idea of separating animal and human, when animal lust to eat flesh grew, it would not distinguish between human and animal flesh. Since this would prohibit animal flesh with a legal prohibition, this meaning if you would suddenly become vegetarian, the result would be you would say, well, you're not allowed to eat animals. And murder and slaughter of people for consumption of their flesh would be widespread. He says, you know what would happen? If you told people you're not allowed to eat animals, they would equate animal and human. And if they haven't yet elevated themselves to the point of being sensitive to the suffering of others, they'd go after people. Now, you're going to tell me that's far-fetched. But do you remember the probably the most well-known vegetarians of the 20th century? Sorry? Hitler and his party. The Nazis were very big on vegetarianism and not being cruel to animals. There's a story told about someone who wanted to show him a movie involving people being cruel to people and people being cruel to animals. And the part with the animals was what bothered him. Why? Take a look at the next paragraph. Still in number 14, but the paragraph that starts with 6. The human sensitivity for the good and the just seeks to fulfill its task. You have a desire to be good. It also knocks at times on the doors of the heart of the wicked, forcing them to seek to quiet their natural hunger for righteousness. They feel like they should be doing something good. Sometimes you will see a cruel, wicked person choose an ethical path, rejoicing to do something righteous, to quiet the rebuke of his innards and the natural regret which beats in his heart. I gotta do something, so I'll be a vegetarian. He wrote this 20 years before the Holocaust. He wasn't aware of what was coming. So what Rabbi Cook says is, don't start on this too early, don't go out of order. First human being, then animal. And so he writes in source number 15, spiritual growth should bring us to elimination. He says, our holy Torah is named Torah. The word Torah means guide. Guide, teaching, various terms you can use that all fundamentally mean the same thing. Indicating that its nature is to guide us on the path of life and goodness. And then he says, and he goes into this at length, and we didn't have time for it here, so I didn't even bother to bring it on the sheet, but he talks about how the mitzvot that surround eating animals are meant to teach a person that this really isn't appropriate. So one of the mitzvot is called kisui hadam, covering the blood of the creature that you've just slaughtered. And on one level, it's about respect for the creature. But take a look at what he says here is in source 15. He says, covering the blood of beasts and birds is a kind of divine protest, opposite the permission which results fundamentally from man's damaged spiritual state. The Torah says, cover the blood. Hide the source of your humiliation and your ethical weakness. In other words, at least realize that what you're doing is wrong, is something to be embarrassed about. That's the statement. When you see paragraphs here, it's because the work, Rabbi Cook's work, is actually published in paragraph form, and that's the way I numbered them. But what Rabbi Cook is saying here, I think, fits with our point that we made going back to week one. The moment that distinguishes human from animal is the divine command that says there's a relationship between human being and God. The goal of the human being is to come to a recognition of the value of all that God created, and to recognize that human and animal are all part of that creation. If we pursue vegetarianism out of pity for the animal, before we've really become sensitive to those around us, it's just going to drag the human being down. We're supposed to pursue it out of recognition of the spiritual worth of animal and human being, and out of sensitivity to their needs. And the Torah is meant, ultimately, to bring us to that point. So at some stage, yes, we are supposed to become vegetarian. It's supposed to happen not just for individuals, it's supposed to happen collectively. And it'll happen when the human being, once again, gains that that spiritual sensitivity. Thank you very much for participating in the series.